This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Welcome back to Tennis Podcast Towers at 2:06 a.m. on day 11 of the Australian Open, where you find myself, David and Matt, and life has been coming at us fast at the Rod Laver Arena for the last few hours. Matt, how are you feeling about Fulham kicking off in less than 5 hours from now?
Pretty terrible. Fulham play their biggest game in very many years in about 5 hours, and I don't feel ready for it at all.
No, we are still in processing mode, I think, all of us, about what we have watched this evening, because there was a point in time tonight where I think we all assumed, thought, were planning for recording a podcast about a desperate straight sets defeat for Carlos Alcaraz at the hands of Alexander Zverev, one of the all-time worst ever Grand Slam quarterfinal performances. Then we swung all the way to the other end of the spectrum and were planning for the miracle in Melbourne part two and how on earth we do that justice. And now here we are, staring down the barrel of talking about a sort of just slightly odd four-set match won by Alexander Zverev over Carlos Alcaraz, 6-1, 6-3, 6-7, 6-4. Where to begin, David?
Well, I think where to begin for me is that just about everything I thought would happen, the opposite happened. Right from the fact that Zverev seemed completely unaffected in the first few sets anyway. I think he was at the end, but he was unaffected by two final set tiebreak escapes over five sets against players, you know, one who he'd always beaten, the other one who's ranked outside the world's top 160, and produced a serving performance the likes of which I cannot remember statistically ever seeing. And Carlos Alcaraz played tennis so bad, I didn't think it was possible for somebody of his ability to play that badly for virtually three sets in a row. And obviously it changed. But I just can't believe, really, that that's what we ended up seeing today. Really, because I thought it was going to be a straight sets win for Alcaraz, as anybody who subscribes to the newsletter knows. But yeah, that was a weird combination.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I was in the same boat, thinking that Carlos Alcaraz would win this match, largely because of the tennis that I felt like I'd seen from Alexander Zverev all tournament hadn't been a particularly high level. He'd been winning matches. He was match tough. We knew that, but I just thought Alcaraz would sort of overwhelm him with his game tonight, and that was not what happened at all. Sort of thinking about it now, like, this was a match that we've seen before, I would say, but this was a much more extreme version. Like that 2022 Roland Garros match, where it was the same pattern. Zverev wins the first two sets, Alcaraz mounts this comeback in the third set and can't keep it going, and Zverev wins in four. But as I said, everything was more extreme. Like, Alcaraz was worse today than he was in the first two sets before, and he had to come back from nearer defeat than he did a couple of years ago. And Zverev was better, I think, overall. Like, it was just a more extreme version. But, you know, I just didn't read that much into the Zverev leading the head-to-head with Alcaraz going into this. And maybe I should have done, because, honestly, Alcaraz looked like he didn't know how to play Zverev. He was feeding Zverev in a way that people usually make Zverev look quite blunt a lot of the time. And actually today, that was anything but the case. He was picking his moments to penetrate the court and attack. He was defending well. And as you said, his serve was just unbelievable. I think 85% first serves in for the match. I mean, he did that in the first set, and I thought, well, that's something that's going to come down. That's going to give Alcaraz a chance. And it just didn't. It was an extraordinary serving performance. But yeah, Alcaraz looked confused, I felt, in terms of how to actually play Zverev.
Yeah, we have seen this before. I mean, Alcaraz's most famous victory started with a 6-1 first set in which he looked, I still don't think, quite as bad as he looked for 2.5 sets today, but he was extremely poor. It's easy to forget because of how it ended up, but we were worried in the first set of that Wimbledon final against Novak Djokovic, worried about it being awkward and uncomfortable and a blowout. And we spent a lot of today worrying about that, and a sprinkle of Alcaraz magic in the latter stages of the third set prevented that. But I think we need to not let it blind us from what a worrying performance that was from Carlos Alcaraz. It was so bad, so bad. It was honestly like all the cliches. It was like somebody in the stadium had a big lump of Carlos Alcaraz kryptonite that was emanating into his system, and he couldn't do any of the things that he usually does. He couldn't think clearly. He was making all the wrong decisions on the court. He's this usually totally instinctive player, and you're thinking, what's he going to come up with next? And I was thinking, oh my God, what's he going to come up with next?
That actually sums it up quite well, because I think that's the dilemma when you have that sort of game, is that both of those two things are possible because of all his options and because of his magic. And it's bewitching and uplifting and exciting when it works, and it's bewildering when it doesn't. I mean, my reaction to the first couple of 2.5 sets was, it felt unprofessional what he was trying to do. He wasn't knuckling down and grinding. You know, when things aren't going that well, when you're not playing that well, you've got to get back to the basics. He wasn't doing that, and I thought, that's a real back to the drawing board job to me. And then I thought, well, maybe it's not that surprising. He's played 10 or 11 sets all year, because he's only played this tournament. He's had no warm-up event at all. Zverev's played 31 sets before this match. Alcaraz has played 12. And that can go both ways. I think towards the end, it could very easily have been the same conversation. Uh-oh, Zverev's played 32 sets. He's getting blisters. He's going to be in trouble physically. Alcaraz will be fresh as a daisy. That's what I expected more to happen today. But actually, one guy looked undercooked. The other one looked match tough. And I'm afraid, I think Alcaraz has got a lot of thinking to do after this. And it's not isolated either, because it kind of happened against Medvedev too. It happened against Zverev that time at the French Open. I think he's got to think about things here and maybe change some stuff.
I think he's not used to playing tactically, or having to even think in terms of playing tactically, right? His thing is just, I've got things that no one else has. And I get that, right? When you've got weapons that incredible, at your best, tactics do become irrelevant. It doesn't matter which way you're hitting your forehand if you're hitting it that hard and that precisely. It doesn't matter if it's going into the guy's forehand or the guy's backhand, but to walk out onto court seemingly without any tactics against a guy against whom it seems to me tactics are critical because he has one wing so superior to the other and such a great serve that surely some statistical analysis of where he serves and where he serves on particular points, etc., would surely come in handy. It looked to me like he walked on court without any of that today. And I think he, on Zverev's serve, it was sublime tonight. He does generally average above 70% first serves in, which for a guy with his type of serve, with his weaponry on serve, is incredible. His numbers were particularly good tonight, but it is pretty extraordinary that he averages that well on the first serve. I do think Alcaraz didn't read it at all tonight. I mean, he didn't seem to get a foothold on it at any point. It just, or on the match in general.
I thought there was a very key period in the second set, wasn't there, where Alcaraz had a couple of break points. I think it was at 2-3. He had the break points. He'd been like atrocious the whole match, but he finally got himself into a game and he didn't take those break points. And in the very next game, Zverev broke him. You know, there's always these little moments, even in a bit of a thrashing, really, for basically three sets. Like, Alcaraz still had his chance then. He didn't take it. And then I felt his attitude was pretty poor, actually, after that. Like, he let Zverev then sort of build this lead in the third set. And sort of all of his decisions were wrong. It was just a really bad performance from Alcaraz. I guess what we should say is, you know, his coach isn't here, Juan Carlos Ferreira. We sort of speculated that could be an issue for him when we knew that Ferreira wasn't going to be travelling to Melbourne because of his knee surgery. And I think, you know, as incredible as Alcaraz is, and honestly, a performance like this makes me worry a little bit, but it doesn't take away from how great I still think Alcaraz is. But I do think there is a bit of a immaturity there in how much he does seem to rely on Juan Carlos Ferreira. Like, it's lovely. I love that relationship. But I do think right now, at this stage of his career, it's very important for him. And not having Ferreira around, you know, you're losing your anchor, you're losing your connection. And he just wasn't really there tonight, Alcaraz. And I have to think that played a part in it. And on the point of having not played at the start of this season, it's difficult, isn't it? Because, you know, half of the semi-finalists here didn't play either in terms of Medvedev and Sinner. And as you said, if he'd been able to extend that match, that might have been an advantage for him later on. But what I would say is that he came into this season off the back of not playing all that well at the back end of last season, whereas Sinner came into this season playing brilliantly. Medvedev had a pretty good end to last season as well. And it just sort of feels like Alcaraz hasn't really played his absolute best since Wimbledon. I mean, he hasn't won a title since then. And you feel like going into a slam, maybe if he just had a few matches, a bit of confidence under his belt, a bit more match toughness, as you're describing there, that Zverev has, maybe that helps him today. But again, he missed Australia last year. He wasn't Carlos Alcaraz, or the famous Carlos Alcaraz, the last time he played it. It's kind of new to him starting a season. And look, maybe got it wrong, but I don't think I would necessarily blame him for the way he's scheduled this season. But, you know, perhaps this is an example that he needs to do things differently in the future, I suppose.
The Ferreira point is such an interesting one, because I was mulling that over in my mind today, because as already discussed, he has started matches and big matches like this before, and Ferreira has been there on those occasions, but he's pulled it together quicker. And I do wonder if a part of that is the presence of Ferrero there. We love it, don't we? His energy from the box. He has this wonderful energy from the box and this wonderful connection. And just looking up and seeing him clearly has an effect. You know, they have a relationship and an effect on one another that doesn't need to be communicated through words. And I get that. Most people in their life have people like that, but it's unsustainable. I think if you need that, not to eliminate the risk of putting in a performance like he did tonight, that's worrying.
There were suggestions at the US Open that he was asking Ferreira where to serve and things like that, and I didn't hear that myself, but that's what was reported. And if that is true, then that concerns me. And because he looked lost all the way through that match, he just looked bereft until 5-2 in the third set. He's 5-2 down. Zverev's tightening a bit. And honestly, some of the stuff Alcaraz played for the next half an hour was as mind-boggling as you can get. It was the sort of tennis that just makes you laugh.
It made him laugh, didn't
it? Yeah. I mean, he was just pulling rabbits out of hats every rally, because Zverev often wasn't doing anything wrong, and yet he would get drawn in and passed. Ridiculous recovery, pass. You know, you're like, what's going on? And the crowd's absolutely exploding. I mean, it was an incredible noise in that stadium at that point. And then we went and got chips, thinking we were in it for the long run.
Who's the we in that,
okay,
David?
Catherine went and got us all some chips, and they were blooming lovely. And it really did seem as though we were going deep into a fifth.
Would I have got the chips if I didn't think we were going five?
No.
Those were five set chips.
They were.
No regrets, but they were. That was a snack haul of somebody that assumed you were going five.
Yeah. And Zverev, there was a drop shot which Zverev chased down in that fourth set, which he sort of stuttered to a stop, and he'd had treatment for blisters. And I'm not sure what if I kind of feel that if Alcaraz wins that fourth set, he might have raced away with the fifth. I mean, we'll never know now, will we? But that's kind of where I was thinking. But yeah, he was really a bit shaky. And again, I just feel it was a bit unprofessional, really, some of the performance.
Did we like the smiling? Like, in the moment, I loved it. And it was classic Alcaraz. But, like, two sets to one down. Still,
I probably did like it.
I did love it. I absolutely did. But I'm just thinking, like, would anyone else have done that? And, you know, maybe that's not the right thing to be thinking, because, you know, Alcaraz can do things in his own way, can't he? But there was a slight sort of, I guess to your point, David, a slight lack of seriousness to that performance from Alcaraz.
Well, that's the thing. I was far more worried about the 2.5 sets where I didn't think he was playing serious, knuckle down tennis. I don't mind the smiling, because he's playing out of his mind at that point, and I feel like that's when he plays his best, usually. Right. And even in the fourth, he wasn't bad for a lot of that fourth. There were just
bad game at four. A couple
of bad errors.
Yeah. Shonky, in Simon Briggs's words. Yeah, I mean, I take your point now in hindsight about the smiling. But I did love it at the time, and I think that's him, isn't it?
I do think that, ultimately.
But hindsight is a wonderful thing for a reason. Zverev's forehand tonight.
Yeah.
How can that have been the same forehand?
He was ripping that thing, and with reliability. There were only a few shockers, and usually there's a lot of them. I think it probably simplified matters in his mind that he just got to go for it and swing and rip and really hit the thing. And by doing that, a lot of the coaches and pros say that's how you get the reliability, is by really accelerating through the ball with the racket head.
Yeah, and what I said earlier about Alcaraz not really knowing how to play Zverev, I think mostly what I was talking about was the way he was playing the Zverev forehand. I just felt was all wrong. He was giving him pace. There was a point towards the end where he, I think actually it might have been the final game of the match, where he got to love 30 on the Zverev serve as he was serving out Zverev. And on that second point, Alcaraz sort of finally started to play with some loop to the forehand and try and push him off the court with it. And he just didn't do enough of that. But that being said, Zverev did hit the forehands that he was getting incredibly well. I just think Alcaraz could have done more to break it down.
I mean, it's for me, Zverev's game is all about pressure. He can absolutely look like and be one of the best, very best players in the world when he's loose. But he has a game that falls apart more spectacularly than other top players, I think, when he's under the most severe pressure and scrutiny. And it's crazy to say this, but Carlos Alcaraz barely put him under any pressure tonight, except for a short period in the match. And that's not to take away from how well he played, but that's just tennis, isn't it? It's question and answer stuff, and answer and reply. It's a game of chess, and he was always in the driving seat. And he's through to the semifinals to face Daniil Medvedev. I know we probably, as impressed as we were and are by Alexander Zverev's performance tonight, I know we probably sound a bit deflated and downbeat about it, and that probably is a bit true. Quite honestly, there is an undeniable, unavoidable cloud hanging over Alexander Zverev and his appearances at this tour, at this tournament, on the tour at the moment, as we've detailed in past podcasts, he has been accused by two separate ex-girlfriends of domestic abuse. One of those has been investigated by the ATP, and they were unable to substantiate those allegations. The other allegations by the mother of his child, Brenda Patea, he will face trial over those in May of this year. In October of last year, he was issued a penalty order and fined €450,000 for those allegations. Penalty order is something that exists in German law, but there isn't really an equivalent in English and US law. But Zverev has contested that, and as such, there will be a trial in May. The ATP doesn't have a domestic violence policy in place, which states that there is any issue with Zverev continuing to compete. So there he is out there, and for some people, this situation, this cloud, will be no hindrance to enjoying his tennis, but we feel the weight of that cloud, and it just exists and is undeniable. Zverev denies all the allegations. There will be a trial in May, but the cloud is there, and it is an ongoing weight on men's tennis at the moment.
And I am confused about the policy, because they were going to have one, weren't they? They said we're going to put one together, and I don't know where that is.
We wait, David. We wait. Zverev will face Daniil Medvedev in the semifinals in 2 days' time. Netflix producers everywhere rub their hands together.
Yeah. They did their documentary episode, and I personally will go back and probably watch what Daniil Medvedev had to say in Monte Carlo. I mean, that's the
I watch that weekly anyway, David.
I mean, that's the element that I remember most. Their rivalry, I mean, what's the head-to-head? It's pretty heavily in favour of Medvedev, isn't it?
Yes, it 11-7, is. It's 11-7. They played, I think, six times last year, and Medvedev won five of them. The one that Zverev won was in Cincinnati.
Yeah.
So Medvedev very much has had the better end of all their recent meetings. Incredibly, they've met 18 times and never in a major. This will be their first Grand Slam meeting.
That hadn't really occurred to me, goodness.
Mm.
That would be an interesting element.
Very much so, I would say.
Yes, I think so, because, you know, major tennis throws up, certainly for the men, when it's best of five, there's a physical element to it, and I think both players will be feeling it physically in a couple of days' time. And then there's also the sort of increased just mental pressure that comes with a big Grand Slam semi-final, and sort of who can handle that. I suppose on that I would probably give the edge to Medvedev, just in terms of his experience in majors. He's won more of these matches, he's been to more of these big finals than Zverev has. But honestly, Zverev's performance tonight has shocked me a bit. I didn't think he had that in him this tournament, based on the matches that we'd seen already. I've obviously totally misread it, because he did have that in him. And if he plays like that against Medvedev, he's going to be a huge handful, even for Medvedev.
It's all about the matchup, isn't it? Because if you just look at their respective performances today, Zverev has it handily. I mean, Medvedev was shonky in places today. I mean, yeah. Convincing in other places, but shonkier than he needed to be today against Hubert Hurkacz, David.
And physically, at times, he looked in real trouble. Mm. The second set, he was terribly flat. And at the end of that, I thought, oh, goodness me, Hurkacz has got him here. He looks really fresh. And I think that tells you something, both in terms of five-set matches, how the momentum and the second wind can change things, and you can just sort of feel better and come through it, and then you can feel rubbish again. And these things can happen several times in the same match. And I absolutely do think that their matchup is just rivalry-wise and style-wise is interesting, and it is a factor in what ends up happening. But there's also no guarantee that the Zverev that came out tonight comes out then, and that the kind of slightly disappointing Medvedev that we've seen doesn't turn around and become what we've seen a lot in the past. I would still, I think, make Medvedev the favourite.
I keep thinking about the New Year, New Me answer that you got from Medvedev in his pre-tournament press conference about how he was portrayed it was in Zverev's Netflix episode, wasn't it? He was just a foil. Medvedev was used as a plot device to make Zverev look extra white knighty and heroic, in a very misleading way, is our view on it. And David asked Medvedev about this in his pre-tournament press conference, and he got a very New Year's resolution-y, I'm not going to get dragged into this stuff anymore. But he also had a look in his eye that said, this is bullshit. and I just wonder if that, you know how at the US Open, he hadn't played well, he'd been shonky up until the semi-final against Carlos Alcaraz at the US Open. And a similar kind of shonky, like a lot of double faults.
How many times can Catherine say shonky in one episode?
Such a good word.
It's brainwormed me now. It's in there. Thanks, Simon Briggs. The same kind of shonky. Lots of double faults, sort of dropping serve and dropping momentum when you felt like he was in firm control. And then he had to play Carlos Alcaraz, whose bunny he'd been all year, and it was like it totally focused his mind, played his best performance of the year out of nowhere. And I do just wonder, in a very, very different kind of way, whether that is going to happen for Daniil Medvedev against Zverev.
Yeah, I think that's a good shout. Because he has been broken a lot, hasn't he, this tournament? He was talking about that in his press conference. 18 times, I think, he's lost serve this tournament. But what I would say is I was very impressed with the way he served in the fifth set today, because, as you said, David, he was flagging in the second set, and he was flagging again at the end of the fourth. It looked like Hurkacz had him physically. But Medvedev was able to rely on his serve in the fifth set, and he kept the points really short. He won a load of cheap points with it, and that's such a weapon for him if that shot is working. I would make Medvedev the favourite, but it's tight, and you don't really know how each player is going to react to having to play the other. You know, we know all of their history, and it does feel like that is probably the key to this match. Like, who turns all of that energy into a sort of winning performance? And I think they're both capable of doing it.
So that'll be Friday. Daniil Medvedev, in his post-match press conference today, he was asked whether he'd been told, whether it had been confirmed to him that his match against tonight's winner that we now know as Zverev would be the second men's semi-final on Friday, because obviously they've played their quarterfinals last, and he said he thought it was preordained in the tournament. So no pleas to be made from Novak Djokovic. It is set in stone, if Daniil Medvedev is to be trusted, that Djokovic against Sinner will be the late day session match on Friday, and then Medvedev against Zverev will be the night session.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life, and of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
We have women's semi-finals to talk about and quarterfinals to reflect on. Before we do that, shall I tell you about On Location?
Yes, please.
Always. The premium hospitality and experience provider, who we are proud and thrilled to be sponsored by throughout the Australian Open. As I have been telling you, On Location has ticket, hospitality and travel packages available for the BNP Paribas Open in Indian Wells, for Miami, for Madrid. Been to both those events. They are fabulous. Roland Garros, in fact, I've been to all these tournaments. They're all fabulous. Roland Garros, Wimbledon, US Open, Laver Cup. I haven't been to Laver Cup. It's on the bucket list, guys. And that is in Berlin this year.
Yep.
Great city. And we have a 10% discount for Tennis Podcast listeners on 2024 Roland Garros official VIP travel packages, courtesy of Steve Fergal's International Tennis Tours. Now, those packages include, of course, top-notch tickets to watch tennis on Philippe Chatrier, but also, my favourite bit of the show, access to La Mezzanine at L'Orangerie, which, of course, is where they hold the draw of the French Open, and it's where they also serve lovely hors d'oeuvres and cocktails to On Location customers. So, sounds great. You can even upgrade to premium access at Club de Loge Lounge, which enables you to get even closer to the action. So, to buy an official VIP ticket package to Roland Garros and take advantage of that 10% discount, just go to toursfortennis.com/podcast and use the discount code CLAYSEASON at checkout, CLAYSEASON, and also remember that if you fancy getting tickets to one of the other events that On Location provides for, we have a 5% discount code applicable to all On Location tennis events besides the Olympics. So that is Indian Wells, Miami, Madrid, Wimbledon, US Open and Laver Cup. And that discount code is exclusively for friends of the pod. So an extra reason to become a friend of the pod. And if you want to become a friend and access that discount code, the link is in our show notes. Terms and conditions apply. Now, if you can remember all the way back to the start of the night session tonight, Zheng Xinwen, three sets for her to book her place in a maiden Grand Slam semi-final over Anna Kalinskaya of Russia. This was a cracking match, David.
Yeah, it was. Right from the first ball, they both came out. There was a little bit of nerves from Kalinskaya, but generally speaking, they both came out playing solid, good quality tennis. And so it was close all the way through the first set. It ended on a tie break for Kalinskaya. And I just thought they did themselves proud on a big stage. And second set, Zheng came back at her, won that 6-3. And then in the third set, we saw something totally different to what we'd seen before. It had been a good match that I'd very much enjoyed. But then I saw what all the fuss was about with regard to Zheng Xinwen. She won me over big time in the next 20 minutes that followed. She won 12 points in a row with just stunning tennis, incredible shot making, and something I really didn't know she had. Two things, actually. One is movement across the baseline, a la Iga Świątek or even Novak Djokovic, the sliding into balls face on the outside leg, the way that they do. And I didn't know she did that. And she's an incredible defender, getting herself back into rallies and finishing them off with winners. And then the serve. She hit three aces in a row at one point. She hit more than 10 aces in total. There are still moments when you look at that game and think, oh, it's going a bit off. You know, she's missing by quite a long way here. But if she can just make those little fine tunes, she could do anything in the sport. She's an absolutely brilliant, mesmerizing player. And I love watching her.
Well said. Yeah. I really enjoyed this match. I thought I didn't think Zheng Xinwen was great actually in the first set. Personally, I thought her forehand was a bit of a liability, but you know the way she picked it up in sets two and three was so impressive, and her sort of presence in the semifinals actually makes the tournament as a whole, you know, you think now you've got Zheng Xinwen, who's one of the rising stars, someone everyone's talking about. Then you've got Coco Gauff and Aryna Sabalenka in the other half. It's suddenly like, oh, this is a very sort of legitimate, as expected, Grand Slam semi-final lineup. Like, I think Zheng Xinwen coming through that top half has really sort of just sort of strengthened the whole tournament, I suppose, in a way. You know, it was obviously a huge surprise in the other semi-finalists, but it sort of really makes sense, I think, that Zheng Xinwen has been the one to emerge from that sort of slightly, well, very open top half once Rybakina and Świątek and Pegula went out. Like, she was probably the next name, and she's really delivered on that, which I find extremely impressive.
Yeah, it goes back to that pressure we were talking about from two nights ago, doesn't it? Mm. There's not only the pressure of, oh my God, what an opportunity for me to reach my first Grand Slam final, but also the pressure of, like, tennis, kind of, you know, all due respect, look, there are good stories among the unheralded names from that have had success in the top half of the draw, and it's our job to tell those stories and to tell you why you should care. But equally, we all know that the bigger the names that progress through to the latter stages, the more attention, the more column inches and the more airtime the women's tournament is going to get. So there is a feeling of, goodness me, our draw's been blown apart here in terms of women's tennis, and we could do with some of the higher profile people coming through. And I feel like you know, that for a couple of rounds now, that has been Zhong Qinwen. I feel like there's been a lot of people relying on her to salvage something from that top half of the draw, and so far she's been doing it. And I hope that's, you know, not a disrespect to the other great, great players that have been in there with her, but she's been marked out, and she's been marked out for a reason.
Yeah, and I really think that that aspect is the most impressive aspect. Like, as good as the tennis has been from her, and as you said, she was awesome in this match and in the latter stages in particular, she's got a route to the final of a Grand Slam without playing a top 50 player. Like, it's kind of hard for me to actually, like, really judge the level of tennis, I suppose. Like, I'm pretty sure it's good, but, like, of course it's good. But, like, she hasn't faced anyone down the other end of the court who is really going to be absolutely right there with her. I would say that's probably fair. And, you know, she will, if she gets to the final, she'll absolutely have that, and we'll see it then. And she may even have it in the semi-final against Jastremska, who, okay, has been up to certainly around 20 in the world. Like, when she's on her game, she's way better than her current ranking, of course. But dealing with the pressure, dealing with that weight of the tournament feeling like it was on her, I think she's done incredibly well to sort of deal with all that. And there have been big improvements in her game that we knew about anyway over the past few months. You know, the serve is still a work in progress, but it's a lot better than it was. The forehand technique, I think, has cleaned up a little bit. Like, we've seen all this progress, and it has come together. It just hasn't been really tested against the very, very top players still, I would say.
I wonder if on the serve she is... I do think she's cleaned things up a bit on the serve, but I do wonder if an element of it is she's playing on bigger courts now, and bigger courts tend to be more sheltered.
Because she's got that high ball toss.
Very high ball
she?
Toss, yeah. I by no means think that is entirely how to account for the improvements, but I just wonder if it's a bit of a factor. I went back after her victory this evening, Zhong Qinwen, to read Matt Futterman's piece that he wrote about her in the New York Times during the US Open last year, when she had her first Grand Slam quarterfinal breakthrough, because it was in that piece and from Matt that we learned about her story of taking up tennis at the age of 7, instantly being marked out as a talent within weeks, it being clear that she stood apart from anybody else in her bracket, and being taken several hours away by her parents to Wuhan, which is a few hours drive away, to show off her game. This is in the words of the piece, to a more advanced coach. The opportunity thrilled her, and she soaked up compliments. But when the whole thing was pitched to her, when she was told about it, she was only 7 years old at the time, her father left out the detail, which she only learned after the hitting session. And the detail was that since she had done so well, she wouldn't be coming home with him, and she would instead stay in Wuhan to train as a 7-year-old. She said, "I cried a lot." That's what she told Matt during the interview. And her grandparents would take turns taking care of her, and she'd get a visit from her parents every 2 weeks. And she said she would beg them not to leave when they would come and visit. Matt talks in the article about how this can be quite common for sports prodigies in China, and it's kind of how they incubate their talent in lots of cases. But obviously for her, you know, the hardship is very much paying off, and it's, you know, I'm sure there's lots of trauma involved, but this is a brutal sport, isn't it? And sometimes hardship can make champions. But there were a couple of other lines from the piece that really stuck with me, and in particular her talking about a breakthrough that she feels like she had last year, towards the end of last year. And she said she she started to make decisions for herself. She said that it actually came very shortly before the US Open last year. She said she's on her own for this trip for the first time. Her mum used to travel with her quite a lot. Obviously, she was a young player. That's not that uncommon. But she said for her first time in New York, she was on her own without her parents. This time, she said she's embracing the time without them, the chance to make decisions for herself, something she said she still needs to work on. For so long, people have been making big decisions for her. Now she's ready to try that for herself. Quote, I'm at this age, in this moment, when I've been feeling quite comfortable on my own. And those were the final words of Matt's piece. And they just stuck with me because Coco Gauff and Aryna Sabalenka have talked about exactly the same thing this week. Taking responsibility for their own actions and for their own career and for their own selves, for their own sense of selves, and learning to fit that into a team environment. That doesn't mean not seeking advice and not being prepared to seek help and be collaborative. You know, all these people exist within team ecosystems, and that's clearly essential, but that's not the same as completely depending on the people around you for everything and decision by committee. You know, to quote Milos Raonic, I am the CEO of Milos Raonic Inc. And it stuck with me when Coco Gauff said it, I think in her pre-tournament press conference. It stuck with me when Aryna Sabalenka said it yesterday, and that wasn't what I was looking for when I went to reread Matt's piece about Zheng Qinwen. It was the backstory of her time in the training camp, but I read through and I came to that and I thought, this isn't a coincidence. This isn't an accident that these players are having success. And it had struck me a couple of weeks ago, I don't want to spoil it too much about the Netflix review episode that we're going to do, but I felt like that was a big theme of this season of Netflix. Players that are grown-ups and make decisions for themselves, and players that aren't. And yeah, so I feel like it kind of underlines a bit of a theme of the week for me. So well done, Jin Chimwen. I think she's a great story. And she'll face Diana Yastremska in the semifinals. What a sentence. Yastremska beat Linda Noskova earlier in... Well, Matt, you're lucky you don't have to participate too much in the chat about this match because you were playing a match of your own at the time at Kooyong, no less.
Mm.
But David and I watched all of this, and it was... Look, we've seen better tennis matches, haven't we,
yeah,
David?
Yeah, this was not good entertainment. This was just such a stodgy match. And I totally understand why. It was hot, humid conditions. Everybody seemed like they were moving in slow motion a bit, as though they couldn't really... raise a gallop, and they're just a bit...
You're talking about my match or Yastremska-Noskova?
We wished we'd been watching your match.
Yeah, I got to be honest, I was pretty disappointed with Noskova, and it was a really error-strewn match. And I understand it. You can't be too hard on her. She's never been in that position before, and she's learning, and she's had a brilliant tournament. And actually, fair play to Yastremska, because... she handled it, and it's the same way she did against Azarenka. She wasn't perfect by any means, but she was good enough. And, you know, she's had a few years of having broken on the scene as this exciting youngster, and then had some stuff happen, and she had a ban for a while, I think, as well. And
I thought you said a band.
She has released a single, I believe.
What?
Mm-hmm. Many years ago. And she said today in her press conference she's planning to release another one.
Oh. But she was able to return to competition. But it's taken a long while for her to get it together, really. You know, she's been quite erratic. Her game has been all over the place, to be honest, for a few years. Obviously, you know, the invasion of Ukraine affected her very viscerally, and her family, and I can only imagine what that would have been like for her. But she's come out here and she's a qualifier, for goodness sake, you know, and she's only two matches away from doing what Emma Raducanu did. And that is astonishing. Again.
It is, yeah. And it's also astonishing, I suppose, you know, there's British bias here probably as well, but like my experience of Yastremska's run to the semis of a slam as a qualifier, like, is so different to, I think, what we're all experiencing with Emma Raducanu. Like, I haven't not noticed Yastremska doing it, but like Raducanu was the story of the entire tournament. Like, I think for everyone, like, I know it was a British thing, but her and Fernandez, you know, they overtook that tournament.
Is it because Yastremska's been top 20? And actually, it's
quite
more,
possibly.
It's more weird that her ranking is where she is and she's needing to qualify than the fact that she's reaching semi-finals as a qualifier.
Yeah.
Or is there something else going on? I agree. It's noteworthy.
I guess Raducanu being so young and so new and fresh, I suppose, like, she wasn't just a qualifier, she was a sort of unknown, I suppose, as you say, whereas Yastremska, at least, like, I think people thought, we know who Yastremska is. Like, she's going to be a streaky player, she's going to have highs, she's going to have lows.
She's going to lose to Madison Brengel, only hitting one winner. That's Brengel, not Yastremska.
Yes.
Here, 2 years ago?
2 years ago, yes. The same day that Aslan Karatsev won a match hitting 100 unforced errors, Brengel won a match hitting one winner. It was like...
What a day.
It's just different ways to play tennis. Just quickly on Noskova, I thought it was quite interesting because, you know, we spoke so much about how her temperament sort of really helped her in that big match the other day against Iga Świątek when she was on the cusp of that comeback. She managed to sort of pull it off. And seemed fairly nerveless. I do think today's performance was kind of the other side of that coin, in that when it wasn't going well for her, you almost wanted a bit more spark. You wanted a bit more energy.
And
I think that's quite a difficult balance to get right. Like, you don't want to lose the calmness that serves you so well in some occasions, but I don't know, I was just looking for a little bit more from Noskova.
And I think that's where the time slot of that match really didn't help, because it was a sleepy crowd. It was too hot for the crowd, and it was kind of, it's like one was looking to the other to be the spark. The crowd were kind of waiting for Noskova to give them something that they could get their teeth into, and Noskova was maybe waiting for the crowd to at least try and ignite her, but neither quite had the gusto in those conditions to spark it for themselves. It was, the women always play first on Rod Laver Arena, pretty much, and mostly play first on the second court, although they do mix that up more. And it's the toughest slot. It's really hard. In the words of Medvedev in his press conference, and I thought this was really good, weather analysis, great meteorology from Medvedev. He said, in Australia, when it's sunny and you're in the sun, it sort of doesn't matter what the temperature is. He said, a couple of days ago against Nuno Borges, it was a 22, 23 degree day or whatever. He said that felt the same to him on the court in the sun as today on a 32 degree day. Like, the sun is the sun in Australia, and it's the sun that's doing the damage. You know, obviously the shade temperature can be very different. And I thought that was great Australian meteorology from Daniil Medvedev. Thanks very much for that.
And he'll get a night match against Zverev, so that'll be an interesting element.
Yes, it will be. And I think he'll be glad of that. He didn't enjoy the sun today at all. So Yastremska against Zheng will be the second night session semi-final tomorrow. They're both night sessions for the women. Obviously, the other one is Coco Gauff against Arina Sabalenka. That'll be the first night session match. The doubles is obviously reaching its crescendo as well. We have both the men's and the women's doubles at the semi-final stages. The mixed doubles final is set. And we had some pretty huge news, a pretty huge turn of events in men's doubles today, which is that 43-year-old Rohan Bopanna, courtesy of his quarterfinal victory today alongside Matt Ebden, reaching the semifinals of the men's doubles, Rohan Bopanna will become the world number one on Monday for the first time in his career at 43 years of age. It's an extraordinary and inspiring story. The guy has a white beard.
Yeah, he really does. I mean, I genuinely thought a year or two ago he was about to retire. And I mean, he is an incredible player to watch. I mean, he's like a Jedi at the net, the way he'll pick out volleys and hit returns single-handedly and just sort of block them back no matter how hard the ball smashed at him. To be doing this at 43, I really don't know how he's doing it.
I'm not sure he does either, but they're a great partnership, him and Matt Ebden. He's got himself a sensation in Australia. They've been playing together. They've played together all of last season with great success, but God, it must be great to have a sensation in Australia. That's got to be a boost.
He was playing with Shapovalov for a long time, wasn't he?
A weird time.
Yeah. He might have got to world number one a bit sooner if...
Burn!
I should say deep dive on Rohan Bopanna in the newsletter.
You know how to pull the punters in, Matt.
I thought, it was only right that
we
gave a bit of a section to this.
It's an incredible story. Good on you, Rohan. That's brilliant. And Ebden and Bopanna will face Zhong Zhizhen and Thomas Mahach. Oh, in the men's double semis.
Looking forward to that. That'll be fun.
The new number one against the best player in the world.
Yeah, something's got to give. The other men's double semi is the German pairing of Yannick Hanfmann and Dominic Kupfer against the Italian pairing of Simone Bellelli, who can't be that much younger than Rohan Bopanna, can he? He's been around forever.
Another one I thought had retired.
And Vavasori. Do we know Vavasori's first name?
Andrea?
Sounds right. Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah. Bellelli Vavasori is that much I'm confident about. The women's double semi-finals are Ludmila Kichanok and Yelena Ostapenko against Gabby Dabrowski and Erin Routliffe. And then the crowd favourite, Storm Hunter and Katerina Siniakova, who incidentally beat Barbora Krejcikova, former partner of Katerina Siniakova today, and her new partner, Laura Siegmund. And it was quite a frosty handshake.
From a massive deficit at the end as well. They overturned. And I saw that too at the end. It was a bit...
cold.
Yeah, and Siniakova was asked on the court what it was like to play against Krejcikova, or certainly what it was like now to have Hunter as her partner rather than Krejcikova. And she said she didn't enjoy playing against Krejcikova. And she said, the main difference is that my new partner is left-handed and I don't want to go into it any more than that. It was a bit like, oh dear. Okay. I mean, they've been friends and partners like forever, like even in the juniors. And I don't think there's been there hasn't been a sort of massive falling out.
A bit awkward.
But it's just a bit awkward.
I do. It's going to be very interesting. They are the reigning Olympic champions. Obviously, they won't be able to play with their new partners in the Olympics because they're from different countries. Will they reunite to defend their Olympic title? Watch this space.
And they did say that when they split. They said, sort of, watch this space for the Olympics.
Yeah, it didn't look like the sort of handshake that said, watch this space for the Olympics. But we'll monitor it. Hunter and Siniakova will play Shea Su Wei and Elisa Mertens in the semi-finals. Now, I know Shea announced that this would be her last tournament in singles, but I think she's doing a Kirsten Flipkins and she's still going to keep going in doubles, right? I don't think we're on retirement watch for Shea in the doubles. If this is her last doubles tournament, she's going out of on a high because she's also in the mixed doubles final.
I tell you what, you're reeling off doubles matches. I really fancy watching her.
Shea is playing with Jan Zielinski, the Polish player, and they face Desiree Krawczyk and Neil Skubski in the mixed doubles final. We've also got the wheelchair events that are reaching their crescendo. I'll bring you news of those over the next few days. But for now, let's talk mascots.
Good idea.
I didn't get points today, did I, for Darwin? No, I didn't. No, we were a Hubert Hurkacz set away, which is disappointing. Francis?
I couldn't have been further away from points because I said Alcaraz would win in three.
Okay, yeah. Matt, Haider
Soma. So did I.
Oh.
At least you didn't say you'd get a golden slam.
Did you... I wasn't going to bring that up because I couldn't remember in what forum you'd said that, David.
Several.
On the record forums.
I just have again. I can't stop saying it.
Oh, dear. We have...
I meant one day.
Well, you'll have another chance one in day 4 years. In at least 4 years' time.
Exactly.
Okay, Billie Jean is sponsored by Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. We have top folks and executive producers Greg, Chris, Jamie, and Jeff. And Matt, we have. Oh, we also have Usher.
Hey for Usher.
I'm going to put another picture of Usher on our Instagram tomorrow.
You do seem to have a real library of pictures of Usher.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've got a folder saved on my phone just called Usher. The R&B artist does not feature. Matt, we have shout outs.
We have Claire Hayden in London.
Hi, Claire.
Hello, Claire.
Claire says, like David, I went to Roland Garros for the first time in 2022. Oh.
Go, Claire. It's good, isn't it? Oh. I still remember that fondly.
We, Matt and I, this week met Natasha, who is a lovely listener who David met at the French Open last year. Natasha is from Sydney, and she met David and told him that she booked her tickets to Roland Garros for the first time from Australia off the back of David's audio diary about his first ever trip to Roland Garros and how wonderful and moving it was. And we were very moved by that story, and we were very chuffed to meet Natasha. But Claire, this is your shout out.
and Claire completed her Rafa slam at that tournament.
Wow.
She's seen him play at every major.
Wow, that's very good cool. I mean, that's like a double slam, isn't it? You've seen Rafa at everyone and you've been to everyone. That is the ultimate. Mm. Very cool.
Well done, Claire. We always say Claire Wood, don't we?
Yeah.
But Claire is quite a common name, and I feel like we should expand our bank of tennis
Claire
players.
Liu.
Claire Liu, that we always say her Liu. As well.
There's got to be more.
Jose Luis Clerc?
Oh, Catherine, that is
well,
not
you,
your best work.
You've had anything. We'll do better for you, Claire. Come back next year, Claire, and we'll do better. Thank you very much.
Next, we have Jose Luis. No, I'm joking.
Claire Wood.
We've got Trip Johnson.
Right, hello, Trip.
From Tennessee.
Trip is a name that only exists in America, isn't it?
I would have thought so.
There's no
British Trip.
No British Trips.
There was a doubles player called Don Johnson, would you believe?
I thought that was going to be a trip then, David, because I really feel like I can come up with some Johnsons.
Okay, off you go.
Steve?
There you have as well. I think mine's more...
certainly more niche.
Yeah, required more thought.
Tennis Trips?
It's 3:09 a.m.
Can't even come up with a Claire, Catherine. You want Trips?
What do we know about Trip?
Tripp's first tennis tournament was pretty recent to Washington, And Tripp says, I can confirm Andreescu's spot on Catherine's intensity list, and that Rajiv Ram is indeed very tall.
Good
stuff, Tripp.
good trivia.
I didn't know that Rajiv Ram's height was up for
debate.
Have
I mentioned that? Has anyone ever contested that?
is he as tall as Yannick Sinner, though? That's the big question.
Thank you, Tripp.
Do you know in the media guide, in the player guide, it's not a player guide anymore, it's a website, the ATP website. Yannick Sinner is listed as...
The internet is going to be big.
That's all I've heard. Yannick Sinner is listed as 6'2". That is ridiculous nonsense. He's the same
they
height.
They are never listed as less tall than they are. If there are inaccuracies on the ATP bios, they are always exaggerated upwards.
He's listed as the same height as Andrei Rublev. That's not right, is it?
Hang on, I'm a bit confused. So you think he's shorter than 6'2"?
No, he's way taller.
Right, okay, yeah. That's what I was saying. But you're saying...
Look, if you'd asked me, without the supplementary info about the bio, how tall is Yannick Sinner, I'd probably have said 6'4".
Me too.
But I just don't... I think those bios, it's always exaggerated upwards.
Well, yes, it is, but I think they did his bio when he was 17, and now he's 20-something.
Okay.
That's right. My theory.
Well, we'll just have to ask if we can measure him.
Yep. Up for it. That'd be an interesting conversation, wouldn't it?
Thank you, Tripp.
Yeah, cheers, Tripp.
Compose yourself. Darcy Packett, we have.
All right, Darcy.
Hello, Darcy.
And Packett is actually spelled like Chloe Paquet.
Oh.
But I'm told it's pronounced Packett.
Chloe Paquet of being a French tennis player of fame.
Like Steve Darcy?
Close. Close enough.
Darcy Bustle, the yep. Ballerina.
I was trying for tennis, but okay, yep. At least you got the spelling right.
Yeah. I think between us we've done quite well there for yep. Darcy. It's a lovely name, Darcy.
Mm. It is.
Darcy Paquet.
Isn't there Paquet. There is a tennis player called Paquet, right?
Yep. Chloe. We've just talked named about her.
You've just named her. So I've had a whiskey. Sorry.
Okay. Thank you to all our shout outs. Thank you to all our friends. Thank you to all of you for listening. Matt's, well, we're all going to be up in solidarity with Matt. David might not be. I may get up and watch Fulham with Matt. I don't know why. In just a few hours from now. So let's get the show off the road. We'll speak to you tomorrow.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.